WMRA News, I'm Dan Easley. The Rockingham County School Board is given a reading assignment. The Democratic primary for Virginia's lieutenant governor heats up, and we conclude our look at an historic house in Stanton. This is the WMRA Daily for Wednesday, April 24th. Two letters signed by hundreds of stakeholders were presented to the Rockingham County School Board Monday night in response to several policy actions taken by the board since January. WMRA's Bridget Manley reports.
Over 200 RCPS educators and former educators, and over 500 parents of children in Rockingham County signed open letters raising multiple concerns with the decisions by the Rockingham County School Board in recent months, and were read aloud during public comment at Monday night's meeting. The two letters followed an unprecedented op-ed published in the Daily News Record last week, signed by multiple past RCPS school superintendents and board members, questioning the ethics of decisions made by the RCPS board, and by a letter penned by students in the system that asked board members to act in a more professional manner. Nancy Bassett, a teacher with the system, presented the teacher's letter to the board. Bassett said that the school board members have used their office to push their political agendas at the expense of teachers and staff.
Certain school board members are manufacturing a crisis in order to push their political agenda onto a nonpartisan elected office and have shared negative and dismissive views concerning RCPS teachers.
Ashley Gordon Becker presented the parent letter to the board.
The characterization of teachers as political adversaries and the dissemination of false narratives about their conduct in the classroom is unacceptable.
The school board has made several controversial decisions since three new members were elected into office in January, including a 4-1 vote Monday night to adopt new policies on the selection of library books that commenters at the meeting called, quote, a massive censorship policy. For WMRA News, I'm Bridget Manley.
There's more information about that story on our website, WMRA.org. Governor Glenn Youngkin has appointed a new leader of Virginia's Alcoholic Beverage Control Authority. Dale Farino, the board's current vice chair, will be the new chief executive officer beginning April 29th. In a statement from the governor's office, Youngkin said Farino's skills will be, quote, vital as we continue to enhance our services, increase revenues, and enforce the regulations that keep Virginians safe. Farino has previously held leadership roles at the private companies Tidewater Wholesalers, Breakthrough Beverage Virginia, and the Coca-Cola Bottling Company. The Democratic primary for lieutenant governor is heating up. From Virginia Public Radio, Michael Pope reports.
The Democratic primary for lieutenant governor is more than a year away, but the dynamics of the race are shifting dramatically this week. Richmond Mayor LeVar Stoney is abandoning his race for governor and instead announcing he'll seek the nomination for lieutenant governor. Here's Wes Bellamy, a political science professor at Virginia State University.
People need to make the decision that is best for them and their family. And I don't think anyone can fault Mayor Stoney for making a decision that is best for him and his family. And whenever a person decides to, again, do what they believe is best for them, that deserves to have a level of respect.
Meanwhile, Senator Aaron Rouse of Virginia Beach is also formally launching his campaign for lieutenant governor this week, including some high-profile endorsements from Senate colleagues Luis Lucas and Mamie Locke. Here's political science professor Jennifer Victor at George Mason University.
Yeah, that's a real power play. I think it shows that he's got some experience as a politician. He's got some savvy skills or advising going on behind him. I think the fact that he's got a little bit of name recognition and is coming out as sort of with a bang here at the beginning will probably help give his campaign a boost. And I suspect it means he'll be relatively competitive.
The Democratic primary for lieutenant governor is in June of 2025. I'm Michael Pope.
This spring, the historic Stanton Foundation began preserving a home with a rich and storied past. WMRA's Randy B. Hagee presents the conclusion of her two-part story.
In part one, we started a journey tracing Edmund Cabell and his family back through the 1800s to the log house he built in Stanton just after the Civil War and the abolition of slavery. the home where he and Eveline raised most of their 9 kids, was passed down to their son Wash. In 1920, a fire broke out after Wash's 16-year-old twins, Mary and Emma, hung some laundry over the kitchen stove, possibly causing the clothesline to break.
We are stepping into a kitchen, and this kitchen was constructed in the 1920s. My understanding is there was one here earlier, but there was a fire.
Frank Strassler, accompanied on this tour by his dog Otto, is the executive director of the Historic Stanton Foundation, which is studying and preserving the home.
We can see the charred logs. They're not destroyed, they're just charred. And once they develop that char, it actually insulates a heavy timber.
First, they'll seal holes in the walls and windows and improve drainage to prevent further water damage.
And it looks a little daunting, but in reality, when you survey the entire building, you'll find that the logs are actually in fairly good condition, but we'll have some limited replacement to do. The big key with any historic house is not to just jump into doing something, it's to plan it very carefully.
One part of that plan is an archaeological study led by Dennis Blanton of James Madison University. In early April, he had students digging small test pits and sifting through the earth for artifacts.
And I can tell you right away that it's not only a story in the ground, but it's a very rich story. We've been finding a lot of information, you know, just on day one.
Allie Tierney pulled out a fragment of what may have been a medicine bottle.
So that's 1800s, roughly. And they use a lot of different colors. And this one's like a aqua kind of color. So this one, they had a mold that they would blow the glass into and then press. And then they'd hand make the neck part to close it off. So when you look at that, if the seam ends sort of right at the neck, that's how you can tell.
Fellow student Sean Menard was excited that his group happened to dig into an old trash pit or midden.
Trash gives an archaeologist the ability to look into their life, their day-to-day home life, what they were doing in the kitchen, what they did for recreation, especially here because we found a lot of ceramics, porcelain, salt glaze, redware. We found brick, cinders, charcoal. We found some buttons that would go on clothing. We found a piece of ceramic that actually had gold into the decoration.
The section of the home Edmund originally built is on the east end of the house. The family had doubled its square footage by the turn of the century. A wood stove still sits in a bedroom.
It's interesting up at this side of the house. Typical log house loft or upstairs bedroom, we're sitting right underneath the gable roof with exposed rafters.
Lori Tate told me that Mama Emma had one upstairs bedroom and Ma Mary had the other, accessed by its own staircase on the other side of the house. Around age 18, Emma Cabell married a man nearly 20 years her senior. After her husband's death, she returned to the old home place. Mary Evelina Cabell never married, working as a cook and domestic helper until her death in 1972. Emma remained in the home until the late 80s, when she moved into the Oak Hill Nursing Home. The Historic Stanton Foundation bought the house for the first time then, in 1987, and resold it to the Cabell's goddaughter, Jean Tate, and her husband Oliver.
They were the upkeepers of the property, and my parents are just known around Stanton as for doing stuff. My brother and my father were the caretakers of Fairview Cemetery until they passed.
Oliver Tate died in 2009, and Jean passed away 2 years ago. Faced with difficult family dynamics around her mother's estate, Lori sold the property to a local builder who wanted to restore the house. He ended up selling it back to the Historic Stanton Foundation. While Lori would have preferred to keep the home in the family, she said the most important thing is that it's preserved.
I just want it to be restored back to its beautiful little self down in that little gully and, you know, just make it look just homey again, you know, just... My mom always went over there every year, and she did the front and had flowers out and tried to make the yard look presentable. It always just looked so inviting when you used to come by there all the time.
The work and care of generations live on at the Cabell House over 150 years after it was built. In the clay and lime daubing between each log, the windows looking out over ivy-covered trees, and the garden hyacinth and tulips that still bloom wild each spring. For WMRA News, I'm Randy B. Hagee.
Find photos of the Cabell House and the historic records referenced in Hagee's story, as well as both parts of Hagee's report, at WMRA.org and on the WMRA app. For WMRA News, I'm Dan Easley. Thanks for listening.